Hey everyone, welcome to your favorite book and especially welcome to 2022. I intended to have this list out at the very end of last year, sort of a send-off to a not-so-great year, by looking on the bright side. But thanks to an unnamed illness, somehow not named COVID, I only had the voice to record this pretty recently. And forgive me if I sound a little nasal and not fully recovered, but then again, COVID negative. And plus, this gave me a little more time to mull over these picks and shuffle the rearrangement a little, because I am going over my favorite books I read this year. Basically, every book I rated 5 stars. And even though I read more this year than ever before, a whopping 101 books, there are only 12 that I gave the full 5 stars. What can I say? I'm a little picky. But honestly, my honorable mentions list for this year was a mile long, and I had to cut it to a merciful 5. We'll get there soon. I'll be ranking my 12 5-star reads and describing them, spoiler-free of course, and if your New Year's resolution is to read more books, and more great books at that, you can start off with this list. And if you're a frequent listener, which I hope several of you are, you may recognize some of these from our episodes this year, but not all of them. So let's dive in. Okay, so at number 12, we have The Shadow of the Wind by Carlos Ruiz Zafón, which I discussed with Maxwell Dunn back in October. I was really surprised to love this one. And before I go any further, I should tell you all that when I say favorite books of 2021, I mean books I happened to read this year, not necessarily books that came out in 2021. I'm not that current, although, well, we will have some of those, so stay tuned. But back to The Shadow of the Wind. This book has so much broad appeal. It reaches across genres and dives deep into this aesthetic of post-war Barcelona, its bookshops and its dark alleys, and it feels very dark academia if you're into that whole aesthetic thing. Daniel is a really compelling protagonist. Fermín is the highlight for me. He was a hilarious side character. And the mystery of this book is really, really potent. There's a lot of twists and turns along the way, which really makes this an engaging read. And come on, it's a book lover's book from premise alone. I mean, just the idea of finding an author that is relatively unknown and almost none of his books are left and you're trying to uncover that mystery. I mean, come on, who hasn't dreamed of something like that if you're a lover of books like myself? However, this book is probably the most flawed of the 5-star reads here. For instance, the female characters have little to no agency, and that's something Max and I discussed in our episode. And I'll also say that the unfolding of the plot in the last act does feel a little hokey, a little bit of info dumping, exposition dumping. I don't want to spoil it for you, of course, but I did feel like the pacing was a little uneven. Check out the book and check out the episode Max and I did if you want to know a little bit more. But if you're in the mood for atmospheric, speculative fiction with a dash of drama, you should definitely check this one out. And apparently a lot of you have, because this is one of the most reviewed books on Goodreads I've personally encountered. And I hadn't even heard of this one before. So if you're like me, if this book has never crossed your radar, definitely give it a shot. And so at number 11, sort of switching gears to a very well-known book, at number 11, perhaps criminally underrated, is Toni Morrison's lauded debut, The Bluest Eye. Criminally underrated because I'm only really placing this at number 11, but I'll explain why. So Nancy Johnson, author of The Kindest Lie, she and I discussed this in her episode in February, which feels like a lifetime ago, to be honest. And I confessed in that episode that I hadn't read any Toni Morrison books before. And that's something I still really intend to work on in 2022. This is still the only Toni Morrison book that I've read. Definitely not going to be the last. This book was absolutely gut-wrenching. There's no better word for it. The tragic life of Picola Breedlove and her family. It's meant to be this one story, this single story, but it is emblematic of larger issues, how the constructs of racism and beauty seek to destroy us all in different ways. It is not an easy read by any means. I mean, if you've heard anything about this book, you know it's not an easy read. For me, why I put this at 11, what holds this book back slightly for me is the prose styling of the ending. To me, this felt a little rushed and a little out of left field in the context of the story. It's a very short book, and so it's very easy for things to feel rushed, especially when you're going at a certain pace. But all that aside, if you are looking to read more classics, which I'm sure is a resolution for many of us, this is a shorter book. It doesn't hold back in its content and its overall writing. And Morrison is one of the greatest writers to have ever lived for a reason. And I certainly intend to read more of her work, and perhaps going in chronological order is the best way to go. I definitely recommend this one. Okay, number 10, switching gears again. I mean, we're all over the place with genre and themes and everything. At number 10, we have Beach Read by Emily Henry. Okay, I need to preface this one by saying I am not a romance reader. I have a hard time connecting to a lot of romance novels, maybe because I'm boring and married, but also because there seems to be so little gravitas to some of the written conflict. And I get it. People come to romance for happy endings and lighter stories, and I enjoy those too. But I still want a little bit of gravitas to the internal logic, the internal conflict of the book. For instance, something that didn't work for me was The Hating Game by Sally Thorne. I'm sorry, the main character's little Disney princess shtick didn't work for me. But this book, Beach Read, this hit the mark for me. First of all, this book was off to a great start on premise alone. These two writers struggling to finish projects amidst personal turmoil. It's part of the same reason I loved Writers and Lovers last year, despite that book's messiness. But beyond premise, January and Gus were both these compelling characters in their own right. January's conflict about the loss of her father, coupled with evidence of his infidelity, that felt really real to me, and her outrage felt very justified. It was a complex narrative that she was trying to work through, and especially in the scope of a romance novel, I really liked taking on that topic. I liked the pacing of this one. I liked how this book displayed different coping styles and how opposites attract, but the still that need for communication and shared context. Basically, Emily Henry won me over with intelligent writing, this elevated prose, her awareness of romantic tropes. She's not ashamed of romantic tropes. She's not ashamed of being a romance writer. But for me, it elevated some of those tropes. I really fell in love with this one. My first Emily Henry, and definitely won't be my last. I've got People You Meet on Vacation, like, right there on my library hold list and cannot wait for it. All right, and so at number 9, we have Bottom of the 33rd by Dan Barry, the first of a few nonfiction books in this list. So I was going over the stats on my reading this year, and almost one-third of my reads this year were nonfiction. This is kind of a really big deal for me. I'm not a big nonfiction reader, and I attribute a lot of that to audiobooks. I find fiction a little harder to keep up with on audiobooks, and as I've said before on the show, I have a long commute and I really need something to listen to, especially in those early mornings. But for me, there's something about a long commute, a good narrator, and a learning experience. There's something about nonfiction that grabs my attention in audio form versus in fiction. I like reading it on paper. I don't know. That's a digression. This book, listened to it on audio, and it was an experience. I'll admit, this is one of those books that maybe I'm the only one into. You know me and my sports books, everybody. This is like Football for a Buck last year. There's always that one sports book that completely won me over and nobody else will care. But this book especially, it's a book-length retelling of the longest baseball game ever played. And you're wondering, okay, baseball is really, really long. No. This is really long. We're talking 33 innings. Regular baseball game, 9 innings. This is 33 innings, minor leagues, 1981, well before my time. And honestly, you might be thinking, how much can you even say about one baseball game, even if it is that long? There's a lot you can say. Barry really did his research here. He calls upon the narratives of everyone from ownership to management to players to clubhouse workers and family members, townspeople, and the story of the town, Pawtucket, Rhode Island, at large. I was taken in by this story, but it was really the final chapter, which was all about the hero of the game. His name was Dave Koza. That chapter just moved me to tears, and it made this book truly memorable in my eyes. Does it help to be a sports fan for this one? Yes. Is it a fabulous piece of writing and reporting in its own right? yes again. So definitely recommend this one if you're looking for a really engaging nonfiction sports story. Okay. At number 8, back to nonfiction, we will have a pick that surprises no one if you've paid any attention to 2021 releases, and this is Crying in H Mart by Michelle Zahner. This memoir was absolutely everywhere, and for good reason, and I had the pleasure of reviewing it for the Chicago Review of Books this spring, and I adore good food writing. It's one of my favorite things. I love it when I read it. I love writing food writing, and this book is full of amazing food writing. Definitely don't read it on an empty stomach, but beyond that, it's a book of complicated love, loss, and the aftermath thereof. Zahner's mother is diagnosed with terminal cancer when she's right around my age, around 25, 26, and this book does not shy away from the detailed ugliness of that disorder. It shies away from the expected schmaltziness because while Zahner tries to connect to her Korean mother through food, she ultimately fails. And I thought that was really interesting. Like, you can't make that very hackneyed connection to the other person based on that one commonality, food. She has to work, dig a little deeper and try a little harder. And this book does linger a little long for my taste. It touches on Zahner's music career. She's a singer at Japanese Breakfast. It doesn't give it much time to develop, and I think at that part it kind of meanders a little bit, but overall it's a beautiful piece of writing. And if you want just a taste, you can check out the initial chapter on the New Yorker website. So the first story, the titular Crying in H Mart, where she's in an H Mart and moves her to tears long after her mother's passed. I read that piece years and years ago, and somehow it had stuck with me for a while. And when I heard about this book, it just reopened wounds I didn't know I had. It's absolutely marvelous. And if you've been living under a rock and hadn't heard about this book, please go pick it up. All right. At number 7, back to fiction. I am so pleased to include a book written by a podcast guest. And this is not the only one, but the first one. And this one is Milk, Blood, Heat by Dantil Muniz. And it was such a pleasure to interview Dantil about her book, because to me, it captured what I absolutely love about great short story collections. Complex characters, attention to detail, form and thematic variability. I could go on. This book is set in Muniz's native Florida, and while she and I hail from different parts of the state, I recognize so much of the atmosphere that she brought to these stories, you know, that sticky heat of Florida, sort of that oppressive weight. One story, for example, Necessary Bodies, it really captured the millennial anxiety about having children in a fraught world, something I've personally been meandering about and something I can relate to. And the title story, it brings to light the anxiety of a friendship on this uneven, uneasy ground. I've said anxiety a couple times here. It's a hard emotion to get right, but this book captures it so well and in so many different ways. Definitely check it out. Whether or not you're a frequent short story reader, I can't recommend it enough. Okay, so that was number 7. And now that we're at the halfway point with a 12-book sort of set, I want to take a little break here to talk about the podcast heading into 2022. So some updates. We're going back to weekly episodes, people. Yes, I've taken a much needed break for a few months by sticking to bi-weekly, but now I'm ready to bring back the weekly content, at least for the time being. For the first 3 to 4 weeks of each month, you can expect our usual interview guests, and I am so excited for the guests we have for January and February. For once, I've actually planned ahead, and so I can really feel that anticipation. But for the last Thursday of each month, starting with this month, January, I'm going to be bringing you something a little bit different. Let me pitch it to you. You ever want to join a book club, but you feel you can't commit too much time or energy to it? Basically, a book club with as little reading as possible. Allow me to present the Your Favorite Book Short Story Club, which each month I will be joined by a guest to talk about a short story of their choice. The guest will be new and old, and while I won't reveal who January's guest is yet, I will tell you that we'll be reading The Waltz by Dorothy Parker. So consider this an invitation. Consider reading the story. It's readily available for free online, and I'll have a link to it in the description for this episode as well. And then join my guest and I on January 26th as we dissect this story in detail. So there will definitely be spoilers. We're going to go deep into the prose here. This is really going to be a fun deep dive on a really shorter piece of prose. And so I'm really excited for this, to put my literary criticism hat on. And the short story episodes, like I said, will have spoilers. So be prepared. Definitely read the story. And I think this will be a great way for all of us to sort of expand our reading tastes and do it in a low-key, low-commitment way. And I'm super excited for it, and I hope you join me. All right, so back to the list. At number 6, we have another podcast guest and a book that just spoke to me on this deep personal level, and that is Shruti Swami's The Archer. Oh my God, this book. It is beautiful on a style level. The dance scenes capture the whirling intensity of Indian classical dance better than anything else I've ever read. But the best part of this book is Vidya herself. Vidya, our protagonist, she is torn between her desire to pursue art with the societal expectations of women of her day. And although much of this book takes place in 1970s India, these are expectations women all over the world struggle with. You know, what do we put aside for the sake of our art? You know, or what do we put aside when we choose to pursue art? You know, families, professional aspirations, things like that. Because try as we might to do it all, you know, that having it all sort of phrase, you see, it often leads to something being sacrificed, even if it's just our good name and our reputation. It's another book that writes about India without italicizing and exoticizing the country or its people, and that's always a plus to me. I really enjoyed Shruti's short story collection, A House is a Body, but this novel hit something deep within me, and now I cannot wait for more of her work, whatever form it takes. Definitely check out the episode that Shruti and I did. Shruti chose a book by Ursula K. Le Guin, which I had a much harder time grappling with, but the talk on her book just invigorated me. And so definitely check out that episode if you haven't heard it. All right. And then at number 5, we are back to nonfiction. This one was a pretty late addition to the list, and it is My Autobiography of Carson McCullers by Jen Shapland. One of the few books I can describe as highly anticipated for me. I'm not one of those readers that's like super in the know when it comes to new releases. I'm rarely someone who's waiting for a new book to come out as soon as I've heard of it. Mostly it's I'm catching up on backlist and older stuff and things I haven't heard. But this one was an exception. As soon as I heard about it, I wanted to read it. And I am surprised it took so long for me to pick up. The book is a biography of sorts of Carson McCullers, who wrote one of my all-time favorite classic novels, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. I even did an episode on how much I love it, so check that out if you haven't. But this book is more than biography. It is a queer reclamation as Jen Shapland sees this kinship with McCullers and seeks to focus on her relationships with women. It's a book full of this ugly personal drama, and it's also important reporting on lesbian erasure in literature, as well as a nice mix of memoir and Shapland's own personal stories. It's a short book. It's definitely appealing if you're a McCullers fan, but to me, it stands out in its own right. It's one of the more unique nonfiction books that I've read, and I just really enjoyed it. All right. And then at number 4, my favorite nonfiction book of this year. So after this, it'll just be fiction from here on out. And this is one I've picked up entirely on a whim. This is CQ by Kristen Radke. If you haven't heard this book, please read it. It is a graphic nonfiction. I always want to say graphic novel, but it's not a novel. It's a nonfiction book, just in that graphic novel format. And Radke's combination of art, research, and attention to detail, as well as just a command of narrative, this creates a masterful work unlike almost any other. It's basically a treatise on loneliness, especially American loneliness. Its biological significance, its history, its legacy. It's not this like boomery rampage against technology or social media, if that's what you're expecting. You know, when people talk about loneliness, it's these kids these days on their phone. It's not like that. It's much more nuanced than that. And it's hard to describe this book in much more detail. Just consider yourself warned by the deep a bit, just consider yourself warned, because there is deep melancholy in this book. It'll bring that out in you. And if you can get through the part about the monkeys without crying, you are a stronger soul than I. So consider yourself warned. But again, absolutely fabulous book. I did not interview Kristen on my podcast, but I want to shout out the Stacks Pod, who had a really excellent episode with Kristen Radke, where she talks a lot about her writing process and about this book. So definitely listen to that and all of Tracy's episodes, because the Stacks Pod is amazing. So check that out. All right. And at number three, we have Exit West by Mohsin Hamid, a book I talked about in detail with SJ Sindhu back in November. This book does not overstay its welcome. I think this is really overlooked in style-heavy books, how easy a stylistic device like long, winding sentences and the comma clauses can grow weary on a reader. But Exit West understands exactly how long it needs to be. It is the perfect length. It traverses the perfect scope, and it combines this real-life depiction of immigration and war and refugee status with these perfectly chosen magical realism elements. Are the doors a familiar trope? Yes, but they work so well here, and they're not even the highlight of the book. To me, the highlight is the relationship. I haven't seen a more real and tender relationship than between Sayid and Nadia. And Nadia, in particular, surprised me so much as a well-rounded, nuanced female character written by a man. I think that needs to be shouted out. It was amazing. And again, this is a great one for audio, but also great in print. I kind of went between the two for this one. It's also really, really short. You really want to take your time with this one. Hang on every word. But if you need a short read to just push you a little bit, this is an excellent one, certainly worth your time and energy. And again, if you don't cry, you are stronger than I am. All right. And then so at number two, we are going back in time quite a bit. Number two is The Age of Innocence by Edith Wharton, the oldest book by far on this list, a definite capital C classic. And it's one that completely deserves the Pulitzer Prize it won. It's hard for me to contextualize this book. It takes place in the Gilded Age New York while being written in the 1920s, giving Wharton a little nostalgia in how she describes this area, you know, several years ago, thinking more on the time of her childhood. But this book is far from being this childhood worshiping good old days kind of work. It's an incisive portrait of social norms and sexism. Newland Archer is one of the most infuriating male protagonists I've encountered, and the contrasts of Mae Welland and Countess Olenska, this presents a lot of real conflict and gravitas, even though these are a bunch of, you know, wealthy people, and they're kind of going to each other's houses. It's like, how much conflict is there? No, there are stakes here. There is real conflict, and the writing is impeccable. Each line is full of tension and deeper meaning. Every line is calling back to something else. It's very intentional prose, if that makes sense. And the very end of this book left me absolutely breathless. This is a book that holds up, even though it's been over 100 years since it came out. And I highly recommend this one on audiobook if you, like me, have a hard time with some of the dense prose of classic novels. I've talked about this before. Sometimes when you're out of school for a while, it's hard to kind of read dense classic prose on paper when you're not used to it, but audio is a great format for that. This is kind of a darker, more cynical counterpart to a Jane Austen novel, except if Jane Austen was written 100 years later and set in America. But if that's not enough of an endorsement, I don't know what is. So if you're looking to read more classics along with The Bluest Eye, definitely pick this one up. Okay. Whew, before we get to number one, let's discuss a few honorable mentions. Oh man, I feel like a YouTuber. All right, so honorable mentions. First one, Gold Diggers by Sanjana Sethian, for being the skewering of Indian American social norms that we all needed with a creative magical realism twist to boot. And then Get a Life, Chloe Brown by Talia Hibbert, for being another one of those romance novels with real conflict and a healthy dose of humor and very sexy. Danny Brown was a fun read as well, and I'll definitely be reading the last of the trilogy this year. So yes, I do still read some romance. And then Unwell Women by Eleanor Cleghorn for being an approachable yet detailed nonfiction work about the neglectedness of women's health throughout history. I had the pleasure of reviewing this one for the Chicago Review of Books, so check out that print review for more in-depth thoughts. And then all the way back to January, Long Live the Tribe of Fatherless Girls by T. Kira Madden for being this wholly creative and complex memoir, taking on all these heavy topics with a focus on artistry, which I really appreciated. And then finally, one of my more recent reads, Word Slut by Amanda Montell for being an engaging and fun take on the linguistics of women in the English language, really combining society with nerdy word stuff. This was a great vacation read, and I'll definitely be picking up her second book, which is Cultish, if you haven't heard of that one. All right, so those are some honorable mentions, and now finally, number one. So, when I sat down to write this list, this was the first one I filled in. I knew from the get-go this was going to be number one, and while I only read it this November, it's already challenging some long-held favorites as one of my favorites of all time, and that is The God of Small Things by Arundhati Roy. Wow, wow, wow. Okay, first of all, the fact that it took me so long to read this is, I'm mad at myself. But honestly, probably a blessing, because I'm not sure if I would have appreciated much of this book as a younger reader. There are the obvious pulls for me. A book set in Kerala, a book that incorporates Malayalam, that was intriguing in concept and made me feel good as someone who recognized a little of the Malayalam. I haven't totally lost it. But what made this book unique was the diverse cast of characters. By diverse, I'm meaning just the number of different perspectives and mindsets we were able to work into this book. The hauntedness of Rahel and Estha, the bitterness of Baby Kochama, the heartbreaking realities of Velitha and Amu, and so much more. What Roy did so well here, in addition to the characters, was capturing this fractured innocence of childhood, down to incorporating this childlike vernacular and song lyrics, even in deeply traumatic moments. So, for instance, if you've read this book, the phrase, orange drink, lemon drink, man, should send a little bit of a shiver up your spine, and the name is part of that. The name is part of that. Additionally, she plays with time in a way I and some other readers have compared to Faulkner, and that's one of the highest compliments I have. I mean, that's one of the coolest things that Faulkner does, is how he plays with time, and Arundhati Roy does it just as well. Now, this book is not for everyone. A lot of the content is very off-putting. It's a novel that does not shy away from more sordid topics. And some of the political aspects of this book may read a little bit long-winded at times. And there have been some South Asian readers who have pointed to how a lot of this book can feel a little catered to the Western gaze. Personally, I don't see it that way, but the criticism does exist, and I want to make you all aware of it. But I'm here to tell you that for me, this was a complete and utter masterpiece. I talk about it more with Mina Sechkin on our episode back in November. We just gush about it for a while. But honestly, if you're at all interested in this book, you just have to read it to understand. It's not a book I can succinctly summarize for you. This really just has to be experienced. Oh boy, that was a long one. So 12 books. Some honorable mentions. My throat wasn't sore when I started, but I think it's getting there now. Again, apologies if I sound a little nasal or under the weather. I'm still getting over that cold. But thank you all for sticking with me, and thank you for listening to another year of Your Favorite Book. I am so excited to continue the show in 2022. It's been one of the few bright spots these last couple of years. It's been a way I've been able to talk to people and relate to people in this time of isolation and just getting to know listeners, you know, people who've known me before, people who didn't know me at all until I started doing this. It's been really great to connect to all of you. Please join me for the Short Story Club. I still have to come up with a name for it, so if you all got suggestions for that, let me know. And then follow the show on Instagram and Twitter at YFB Podcasts for all updates. Mostly Instagram. I'm a little hit or miss with Twitter, but definitely Instagram. And then if you or someone you know is interested in potentially being a guest, please reach out to me. My email for the show is vikareads, V-I-K-A-R-E-A-D-S @gmail.com. And while I am not the fastest responder, I do read my emails. So yeah, please reach out to me if you would like to be a guest or if you know someone who might want to be a guest. Always listening. And so that's it for now. Here's to 2022 and happy reading.